If you have your Bibles this evening, turn to Daniel chapter 5, please. Daniel chapter 5. If you don't know where Daniel is, it's Genesis, Exodus, Daniel. I'm glad some people got that. Found it funny, so. In the book of Daniel, there are many different stories that are often read about and learned from, whether from the Sunday school stories of the Daniel and Goliath or the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, different things. There are many different types of lessons and things that people can learn from have been pulled from Daniel. And one thing that is very useful for there is the fact that these four Israeli boys here, that the missionaries or the testimony that they had there and the missions that they had among those people. But today I want to focus on not the exiles that were there in the nation of Babylon, but instead the three kings that ruled there during their time. And so, and while we're there, we will look at one specific attribute that all three of them had, and that was the sin of pride. If you look with me in Daniel chapter 5, verse 17. This here, he's talking to Nebuchadnezzar at this point. It says, "Then Daniel answered and said before the king, 'Let thy gifts be to thyself, and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king, and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom, and majesty and glory and honor. And that for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. Whom he kept alive, he kept alive. And whom he would, he set up, and whom he would put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was disposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him.'" And so here we see the sin that takes place. In this part, the story has developed into this, and it's what is taking place is Daniel is actually talking to the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar. And he is looking at him and saying, "Your grandfather was put into his position by God. God set him up there, and God is the one that gave him that command, gave him that rule, and gave him an immense power over all the earth. But when he let it go to his head, when he lifted up his heart and saw the works that he had done, that is when his kingdom was taken from him. And God gave everything that Nebuchadnezzar had to him. He gave him his kingdom, his majesty, his glory and honor. And for all of that he gave there, everybody trembled before him. The name Nebuchadnezzar was one that was feared throughout all of the known world at that point. His armies were the strongest. His empire was the biggest. That is who Nebuchadnezzar was. And while he was there, he was the one that went out and was shown his glory to everyone. In fact, it even talks about that Nebuchadnezzar, as you know from the story of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that he built a golden image. Many believe that it was a statue of himself and required the people then to worship it. You don't do that unless you have somewhat of an inflated ego, is having people worship a 90-foot golden image of yourself. And all of these different things that he did there showed his pride, showed that Nebuchadnezzar was willing and wanting to go there and to claim all of the glory. But we see the consequences of Nebuchadnezzar's pride. And this is one of the things that it's the story that we look at, and when you hear about it, you're like, okay, wow, that's crazy. But when you really begin to think about the story, the consequences, and what it meant for Nebuchadnezzar and for the kingdom, it makes you slow down a little and to realize how much power God has over us and how he feels about the sin of pride. Look in verse 20 again. It says, "But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was disposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. And they fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomever he will." And so his kingdom was taken from him, is the first consequence that we see of Nebuchadnezzar's pride. He was just deposed. The reins of the kingdom were taken away from him. But what I found interesting is not that God took the kingdom away from him. God simply made him act like an animal. It was his own people that took the reins away, that took away his command. We see that in the end of verse 20 where it says they took the glory from him. They, meaning his people there, not God. It was his own consequences of what God did that caused this to take place there. And he did not give up his kingdom willingly. I guarantee if you ask Nebuchadnezzar after the end of this ordeal, that if he would have chosen this punishment that he had of living like an ox or a different punishment, he probably would have not have chosen that first one there. And so he was put out to pasture, quite literally there. God says, or the Bible says, that he was made like the beasts, that he dwelt among them. Now, let's think about that for a moment, of what that really means for Nebuchadnezzar and for the kingdom there. You are, if you're Nebuchadnezzar there, you are the most powerful man in the world, controller of everything, leader of all of the nations there, the empires that are there. Everybody pays homage to you. They pay the tribute to you. And then the next day, somebody comes to check on you, and you were acting like an animal. Nebuchadnezzar there is in his bedchamber. He's snarling, grunting, making those noises there. And it gets to the point where his people can't hide it anymore. Their king is literally a cow at this point. It talks about earlier into the Bible, the story here, that his nails grew out, that his hair grew out, things like that, that they put him there and they fed him grass because that's all he would eat. So he goes from the most powerful man in the world to something that would have had to have been an incredible embarrassment to the nation there because of his pride. And showing that there, that he had to sleep outside, that he had all those things. The morning, the dew, it talks about, would wet his body. And so looking at that, we see that what God has done there with Nebuchadnezzar is not just taking away his kingdom, but he's taken away every single thing that Nebuchadnezzar possibly could have been proud about. With God, what he did there with his consequences, Nebuchadnezzar, he could have taken the kingdom from Nebuchadnezzar, had him deposed in some way. But if that had happened, then Nebuchadnezzar still could have said, well, I was at one time the ruler of the world. Nebuchadnezzar could have looked and said, I had all of those riches. I had all of that power. I had all those people that were looking after me. And it was taken away, but you know, that kind of thing happens. Or even if in the annals of history that are going through there, that the looking at that, the people that were around that time, that were the scribes there, could have seen it as Nebuchadnezzar was the best. He was the greatest. And when he died on the field of battle, being the leader of the world. But instead, what those scribes would have been writing about was that their king was having to live in a barn and eat grass like an ox. God took away every single thing that he had to be proud about. And that looking at that for our own lives, that is something that is incredibly eye-opening and somewhat scary for us. How often do we catch ourselves as saying that we are proud of something, that maybe even we don't even say it, but by doing something, by our actions and by our attitudes with people around us, our pride comes out and does it in that way. And thinking about that, there was a illustration that somebody told me one time. And the pastor was up in the front of the auditorium, and he asked here, who does not have a problem with pride? And it's one of those kind of, it's almost like a trick question where if you raise your hand, you appeared prideful, saying, I don't have a problem with pride. All of us in some area of our lives have the inkling of pride there, that have something we are proud about, that incorrect pride there. Now, there was okay with treasuring something or being respectfully proudful about something. But what do you have in your life that is you are being prideful about that God is looking at saying you have no right to be proud about that? One thing that I look at and I think about often is the benefits that every individual has, the talents, the personality traits, even the physical appearance. That before we were born, we didn't get a little check sheet and say, okay, I'd like to have all of these things here. The musical talent for some people, the personality for others, the physical abilities for even more people. We didn't get to choose those. All of those things that we are given, whether it is athletics, whether it is intelligence, whether it is a music ability, it all comes from God. And it's not something that we can look at and focus on for ourselves. We cannot take any credit for that at all. It is all for God, and we are supposed to use it to give the glory back to God. Several years ago, Tim Tebow was a quarterback in the college leagues of the football. And his name became famous because after every touchdown, after every major play that he did, he would kneel on the field there and he would pray. And it took national headlines there about what he was doing. And it pushed him into that light there, that he was giving that glory back to God. And that is what we're supposed to do with our talents, with our abilities, with our actions, is point everything back to God, putting none of it on ourselves. And so this here, Nebuchadnezzar chose his pride, chose his sin, but he was obviously unable to choose his consequences. And so we see that there. We see Daniel talking to Nebuchadnezzar, or talking about Nebuchadnezzar to Belteshazzar. And the reason he's telling this story, and it goes right into the next part, is that we see what takes place and that Belteshazzar himself also has this sin of pride. Look in chapter 5, verse 1. It says, Belteshazzar made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belteshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines, might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and his wives and his concubines drank in them. And here we see Belteshazzar. And what is he doing? He was having a great banquet for his captains, for his princes here. That was not uncommon. I say that phrase a lot, one thing. I just realized that. I'm sorry. I don't try to repeat things like that. But if I do that again, somebody wave at me and I'll try to stop saying that. That's obnoxious when people do that. And so I almost did it again. A certain thing that kings would do back then was they would, in order to show their pride, in order to show their grandeur and their money that they had, they would throw these immense banquets. We see this all the way up even to today, that banquets are thrown in the capitals of nations by rich people, by all over the world. This is something that has taken place, as they invite their friends to see how good of a meal, how good of a party these people could throw. And that's what Belteshazzar is doing here. It's not uncommon there for what he was doing. But what makes this so interesting at this point was it was a very foolish action to take place. If we look at the history behind the story, look at the cultural context of Daniel, we actually realize that his kingdom at this point of Babylon, is his city itself, the city Babylon, is under siege from the Medes and the Persians. His entire city is surrounded by thousands and thousands of enemy troops. And what is he doing? He is throwing a party, a drunken brawl, really, for his best generals, for his friends, for his princes, and all those people there. That is what Belteshazzar does. And why does he do that, though? Why does he go out there and decide to throw this lavish situation? He is worshiping his gods. He is showing there that my gods are more powerful than the gods of the Medes and the Persians because they haven't conquered me yet. My gods and I, we are still more powerful than them. Not just that, but while I'm here during my party, I want to show that I'm more powerful than that God of Israel. Go ahead and bring his cups, bring his instruments that are supposed to be meant for his worship, and I'm going to use them now to worship my gods. And we see that in verse 4. It says, they drank wine and gave praise of God of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood and stone. And we see that, and to us that doesn't really, you know, we generally don't worship gods of gold and stone and iron and things like that. But what was he doing here? What was he actually doing? Let's look at the specific things that the specific gods that he was worshiping. The gods of gold and silver. Even to this day, money and precious metals is used as a monetary value. They're used in that way to buy things, to sell things. On the world market, there are massive amounts of these metals being bought and sold every day. And so what he is saying here is he is worshiping the gods of money. And all of us here could be guilty of that same thing, of worshiping the gods of money. Now, you also could be looking at saying, psh, you don't know how big my paycheck is. There is no worshiping going on there. And that, even with that, though, the amount of money we do have, what we have, how much interest do we put into that? How much power does that money have over us? Are we constantly trying to make more money so that we look better from the people around us? That we look like the ones that are supreme there? That we have the nicest car in the parking lot at work? Something like that. Are we trying, again, to use our money and the sin of pride to make ourselves bigger? Then he goes and he praises the gods of brass and iron. Back then, those were the instruments used for war, whether swords and spears or coats of armor. that was what he was doing there. He was worshiping the gods of his military strength and his might. Because again, he ruled the greatest empire in the world. Babylon was considered impenetrable at that point. And then finally, he looks of wood and stone. Even today, those are still used for building materials. His worshiping there, the great things that he has built, the things that he has designed there for Babylon. His pride is so great that he begins to worship the individual building materials of his nation. Do we get caught up in the same thing? Do we get caught up so much in how our house looks when somebody comes over because we're afraid they're going to think badly about us? Now, there is a point to having a tidy house. The phrase, the cliche that cleanliness and tidiness are next to godliness. And it's true. Like, that will show what you think about things. But is that what your soul focus is on? Is making sure that nobody can think anything badly about you because of what you dress or how you dress or what your house looks like. And so when this takes place, we see how foolish Belshazzar was, not just by throwing this great party and worshiping all of these gods, but also how foolish he was for tearing down the God of Israel. This morning, I made the great point of showing that he is the living God. And what Belshazzar did not fully grasp, it didn't click in his mind, was the story of his grandfather. We saw that David had just recounted that to him. And look at verse 22. And what we see here, that after Daniel has told this story to him, he looks back at Belshazzar and says, "And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast thou not humbled thine heart? Thou hast knowest all these things." In other words, you knew all about these stories and you still chose your sin of pride. "And you have but thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and thou hast brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives, and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. Thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and who are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified." Then was a part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing that was up there. It was, "Mina, Mina, Tekel, Upharsin." And the interpretation of the thing is, "Mina, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Peres, thy kingdom is divided, given to the Medes and the Persians." And so here we see what takes place here. The handwriting on the walls, where the phrase comes from of this story. And that's why Daniel was called in. During this drunken party, what was taking place, a hand appeared and drew on the wall. Many of you are familiar with the story. And he goes through here. And taking place, and God looks at him and says, in the first part there, "Mina, Mina." He says it twice. The Bible does not waste words. God does not repeat something here because he forgot that he said it the first time. He uses it twice to emphasize what he has done. And it's the idea that what is going there is that God has measured your kingdom. And he looked at it, and he's numbered it, and it's finished. You're done. I've measured it twice to make basically the idea there, done this twice, and it's it. You're done as a ruler. I am no longer letting you lead. And then Tekel is saying, "You are being weighed in the balances and are found wanting." Many of you would understand and recognize the symbol of the Lady Justice, that in one hand she has a balance, in the other hand a weapon, and she's blindfolded, meaning that justice is blind there. And here it has that same idea where God put Belshazzar, his kingdom, and the way he had acted on one side of a balance and put God's holiness and what was expected of him on the other side, and there was not enough. It did not even out. And he says that when that's happened, you're found wanting. There's not enough there. And then finally saying that your kingdom is going to be divided between the Medes and the Persians. This was a prophecy that had been given to his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. And that was about to happen, was this kingdom was about to be divided. And so we see here, we see Nebuchadnezzar's foolishness and raising up his own heart and seeing the glory that he made and looking at that he was the ruler of the world at that point. Then we see his consequences. We see Nebuchadnezzar's consequences of being turned into an animal for 7 years, it talks about, that he lived in the fields among the beasts. Then his grandson, not understanding and not getting the point there of what is taking place. His pride shows that he believes his city to be impenetrable, cannot be defeated by this army that is literally right outside his front gates. He cannot be done there, but God looks at him and says, "No, you are going to be destroyed. You are done. And then we see what takes place there. And the consequences of Belshazzar's pride is that his kingdom was lost. We see in verse 30, it says, "In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old." Now those two verses there don't really give the full explanation of what took place there. Again, looking at the cultural and the historical background of this story, we see that the walls, again, of Babylon were believed to be impenetrable. And not just were they impenetrable, but it was built literally crossing the Euphrates River. In a siege, one of the big difficulties is running out of fresh water, because if you don't have a supply, the people are going to die of thirst. Well, they didn't have to worry about that. They had an entire river flowing through their city. In order to keep the enemy out, they had built a gate into the river, which kept them from swimming under the river. Because again, you can't go into the river in that way when you're in full battle armor. You will sink, you will drown. And so their city was unstoppable. You could not break through this city. But what the Medes and the Persians done, several miles upriver, had actually built canals and dams and redirected the entire river of the Euphrates around the city. And what that allowed to do, when the river dried up, when it was the water had stopped, when they put the final rock in there and stopped the water flow, the Medes and the Persians quite literally marched right under the walls of the city and into the city there and took place. And would they have been as? Why were they so able to do it though? Yes, God had called punishment, but all of the princes, all of the generals were drunk from the party the night before. They were not able to do anything. They weren't able to lead. And so we see Belshazzar's consequences for losing his kingdom, of losing what was most precious to him. All of those things, his fame and his glory, again, because of his pride, were all taken from him. You cannot, again, he chose his sin, and you can choose your sin, but you cannot choose the consequences of that sin. The final king that the book of Daniel emphasizes is Darius in chapter 6. We see his chapter 6, verses 6 through 9, says, what takes place before this was Daniel had been in position there, had been loved by Darius, was being put into many high positions, and the other rulers, the other elders of the country did not like this. And so they come up and try to find an error with David, or with Daniel. Verse 6, "Then these presidents and the princes assembled together to the king and said thus unto him, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, then the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it may not be changed according to the laws and the Medes of the Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree." We see Darius's pride here creep up. These men knew how to butter King Darius up. They knew how to make him do what they wanted. They come in there, and with their respectful tone and dripping with just adoration to Darius, saying, "O king, live forever." In other words, "I wish you could be our king forever. You are so good at it." And what he does there, and then they say to him, as you can see, "We want to make a law that nobody can be worshipped except for you." Now, in our day and age, that wouldn't really be something that would affect us very much, you know, people worshipping us. But if somebody came to you in your workplace, in your home, something like that, where saying nobody is allowed to do anything unless they get direct permission from you, you will be the supreme manager of this area. That is something that is a pretty good deal there. I mean, you get to do whatever you want. You literally, Darius at this time could move the kingdom in as his own image of what he was wanting there. And so that's what they did. And they tried to get him to sign this law. And they knew how to do it. They knew how to tempt him into this. Sign it into the laws of the Medes of the Persian, which was unbreakable. And they played on his ego there. Darius knew he was a powerful king. He had just led the revolt against the Babylonian kingdom, had taken it over in that way. He was pretty powerful. He knew what he was doing. So why shouldn't people worship him? I mean, him and his gods literally just destroyed Babylon. So why shouldn't they go up and be the ones to him, be the one that was worshipped there? But God has said to us in Isaiah chapter 55 that we can't trust man, what man says or even what we tell ourselves. In Isaiah 55:11 it says, "So is my word that goeth out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it." What God is saying there, that I am the one that sends forth things and I am the one that accomplishes things. I am the one that wants to do this and chooses to do things there. In your lives, what temptations, what things can be specifically tailored to you to allow your pride to blossom? There is some people that I know that have incredible abilities, whether it's sports or music. And I'm thinking of very specific people here, and ones I went to school with, and they made a point to, they asked their friends and people around them that if they did do something well on the sports field, was to not congratulate them. Because they knew as soon as they were congratulated and said, "Hey, great job on that goal," or "great job with that play," their pride would take over and they would think along the lines of, "Yeah, it was a really good play that I did there." And what they did, it seems almost prideful to say, "Hey, don't do this because my pride will get up." But what they were doing, they were trying to work at being humble there, knowing that it wasn't their own ability that did it. It was something that God had given. And with Darius here, they knew what buttons to push, what to tempt him with to get his pride to control him. What temptation comes with you? What do people have to say in order to get your pride up there, in order to butter you up in certain ways? Growing up, I have an older brother and a younger sister. And personally, I know I'm the favorite child. Now, my parents would never tell me that, but I just know. It's one of those things that I just have an inclination. And I am. I really am the favorite child there. And I don't know if they're watching tonight, but Mom and Dad, you know it's true. And so, but the thing is, my little sister, she's the baby girl. And so regardless of me being the favorite child, regardless of what I'm trying to do, if I really want something, or if she wants something different, she will be the one to get Dad to do it, kind of thing. Like, there are times I'll go up and I'll look at the situation and be like, "I need to ask Dad if we can do this, but I don't think he'll let me. Tammy, get over here." And so Tammy will go and she'll talk to my dad, get the situation, and we'll be able to do it. It's kind of thing there. And a lot of people, they have certain, and it's playful, it's never been anything serious, but it's the kind of thing where you know whom you have to ask and how you have to ask in order to get your way. It's just one of those things that we learned growing up. And regardless of the fact that I was a favorite child or not, it was my sister who I knew how to how to get my dad to see my way. And so there's all of those things there. It was what I was able to do. And that's a danger for all of us, though. The devil has been doing his job for thousands of years. Our flesh has been something that knows us from the beginning. And it knows how to manipulate us, how to get you to do the wrong thing. And oftentimes that is with our pride. When stand-up comedians are up on stage, and if somebody heckles them for a crowd, what they will often do is point out a physical attribute about that person and tear down that person in front of everybody else, destroying their pride. And that is what the opposite of that is what temptation does to us, though. It will build us up. It will get us in our mind, and it'll be stuck there. It'll be something that we can't get past. And that's what they did. And one of the dangers, though, and we see what happens here with Darius, is the dangers and the consequences of our pride and letting our pride lead our lives. Look at verses 10 through 16a. It says, "Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being opened in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he did aforetime. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. Then the men came near and spake before the king concerning the king's decree. Hast thou not signed a decree that every man that shall speak a petition of any god or man within 30 days, save of thee, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the laws of the Medes of the Persian, which altereth not." Then answered they and said before the king, "That Daniel, which is that the children of the captivity of Judah, regardeth thee not, O king, nor the decree which thou hast signed, but maketh his petitions three times a day." Then the king, when he had heard these words, was sore displeased with himself, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king and said unto the king, Know, O king, that the laws of the Medes and the Persian is that no decree nor statute which the king establishes may be changed. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. And so we see here his rash decisions of what is taking place, that he did not think it through. All he saw there was his own pride being built up. What he would be able to get, that people would have to worship him, is what he saw there. He knew that Daniel was loyal to God, and we'll see that in a moment. He knew that Daniel had served God, and he knew that Daniel was a good man. He was the first of the presidents. He was the head leader, his head advisor there. But Darius, when he did this, was not thinking about how his actions would affect others. It was only about how it would affect and would please him. And again, that is what happens to us, is that we will look and we will do things and how they will affect me. How will I make my life better by doing this? How does my pride and how does being and doing the right thing or the wrong thing affect me? And so we see that takes place there. And he had to follow through the law of the Medes and the Persians that had taken place there. But we see something, though, differently here. Look at the second half of verse 16. And this shows that Darius knew who Daniel was and what kind of God he served. It says, Thy God whom thou servest continually, he will deliver thee. And then jump down to verse 20. It says, And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? What we are able to see here is that Daniel's example and testimony was one that was a shining beacon to all of those around him. And that is really the opposite of what we've seen of Nebuchadnezzar, of Belshazzar, and of Darius. Twice, we see that Darius looks at Daniel and says, the God whom you serve continually. Why were these men, why were these other princes and elders able to trap Daniel? They were able to trap him because he had a routine. Three times a day, he would go to his window that was towards Jerusalem and pray towards the temple there. Without fail, every day he did that. Even when he heard the decree, he knew that he continually had to pray to God there. But one thing that a lot of people don't think about there, and what takes place, is Daniel did not have to continue praying towards the temple. Was it a commandment of God for him to pray, or to any of the Israelites, to pray facing Jerusalem when they prayed? No, they did not have to face Jerusalem. They didn't have to have that window open. Daniel could have gone to a different room of the house. Daniel could have closed his windows and still prayed. But the thing was, if Daniel had done that, if he had chosen a different location to continually pray to God, then those men who had been watching him, those that had seen his testimony, would have looked at that and said, we got him. He stopped praying. He doesn't follow his God nearly as much as he says he does. His God is not important to him. With you all, with your testimony, whether at your workplace, with your family, with your kids, is your testimony one where they could catch you doing the wrong thing because you consistently do the right thing? But they catch you doing the right thing because you consistently do that thing, where they are trying to do it that way. There's Rand Hummel, the director of the Wilds of New England, said that when he was had his little boy at home, his boy's married and moved away now, but when he was younger, he was downstairs doing his devotions. And he had his cup of coffee there in his recliner, and the little boy comes out of his room and has a little Bible story coloring book with him. And he crawls up on the recliner next to Rand, and Rand looks at him and says, what are you doing? He's like, I want to have my devotions like my dad, is what he says. And he has his little Bible coloring book there. Are you so consistent with your devotions, with your prayer life, with your testimony, that somebody could catch you doing the right thing because of how consistent you do it? And if you stop doing the right thing, would somebody notice that again? There are many jobs in the world, whether IT, janitorial, things like that. If they're doing their job perfectly, you never see them and you never notice they're doing it. But as soon as they stop doing their job, you know it immediately. Daniel, when he was praying, people saw what he did there, and they would have noticed immediately if he had changed his testimony. And so he could have went and changed his routine, done something differently, and in that place it would have saved his life. But he knew that God wanted his testimony to be one that was a shining beacon to the people around him. You have the children's song about putting your light under a bushel and doing it that way. That's what Daniel would have been doing if he had stopped his testimony, if he had stopped his praying in front of the window. He would not have broken any laws from God. He would have been completely righteous in that way, but he knew that they were watching and they were waiting, and he did not want to give a bad report of his God to those people around him. And we see also in verse 20 where Darius looks at him and says, "O Daniel, servant of the living God." Again, that comes up here, where Daniel's testimony was one that he served the living God. With the people around you, again, do they know what kind of God you serve? If somebody came up and asked them and said, "Hey, what does so-and-so do? What do they serve? What is their main motivation in life?" Would they say it is to get people to like you? Would they say it is to get the money, to be the best at whatever it is, the sporting event? Or would they be able to say, you know, they serve God. And they may not fully understand what that means. You may be witnessing to that person, but is that what they know there? I've had several people mention this when I was in youth group and even now, that with our youth group, we have a good group of kids. And we do. We do have a good group of kids. I really enjoy working with them. But one thing that I'm trying to work with them and trying to develop is I don't want just a good group of kids. I don't want just to be at a good church. I want to be at a godly church. I want to have a good and godly youth group is what my goal is there. And that's what I'm striving towards and praying towards there. And that's what Daniel had. He didn't just have a good testimony, a good reputation with the people around him. He had a godly testimony, knowing that what he did there would affect people around him. And we see that from the king of the nation is saying to Daniel, the God that you serve continually, that you always are serving, you're always serving your God, he will be able to deliver you. This living God that you serve all the time, he is the one that is able to deliver you. And then Daniel looks at him in verse 21, it says, "And then Daniel said unto the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel and has shut up the lion's mouth, and they have not hurt me. For as much as before, innocency was found in me, and also before thee, king, have I done no hurt." And what we see here, Darius's rash decision, his pride, his desire to be the best, to be the only one that people worshipped, endangered the lives of those around him. And that is what the consequence of his sin was, is he had to condemn to death one of his best advisors there. What consequences will your pride have on your relationships on the areas around you? With Nebuchadnezzar, we saw that it was himself. His pride affected him and the situation of him being sent into the fields there. With Belshazzar, we see that his pride affected his entire household. His entire kingdom was affected because of his pride and his arrogance. And then we see with Darius, we see that it affected those immediately around him. We cannot choose our sin, or we cannot choose the consequences of our sin. That pride, they all three chose, but none of them chose what was a consequence of that. They saw what they wanted, and they did it. They did it because of the pride there of what they were able to do. In Proverbs 16, verse 18, it says, "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." And these three stories here, these three kings, are perfect examples of that, of how they were destroyed, of how they fell, how they were brought down because of their own pride and their own desire to build themselves up. And so with all of this here, with Daniel, with what he had done, what is so amazing to me is that not only did Darius see Daniel's testimony, know his pride, know that he continually served God, know that he had served the living God, but when he called down into that pit, he actually expected to be answered. In that day and age, that was their form of execution, how they put the people in the pit there. And when he cries down into the pit, he says, "Did your God deliver you? Are you still alive?" And he was hoping, he was expecting an answer, all because of Daniel's example. When you get into a situation, when people around you see you are in a hard time, can they know how you will react? When in high school, I used to work at Target, and I had this situation happen where I was working with somebody and I was just dealing with something, and they came to me later and said, I would like to thank you for how well you've acted, how you have been, they actually said, a beacon here in the store. They gave me a card, and all the managers had signed it, and I was like, okay, I was just doing my job. And then one of the other workers who had been hired with me said, I want to get a card. And the managers kind of looked at that person and then walked away. And it took me a few weeks after thinking about it, like, why did they give me a card and all those kind of things? And it was finally when I realized, you know, I was just doing my job. I was doing what I was supposed to. I was doing what I was told. And to realize that the opposite was true of those that were around me. That person that said, I wanted a card too, they had not been doing what they were supposed to. They had not been meeting their full requirements. With us, with your testimony, are you meeting your requirements that God has set out before you? And knowing that no matter what the situation is, no matter where you're at or what you're doing, the people around you should be able to look and say, that person is serving the living God. Not just a living God. They constantly are serving Him. They are constantly bringing up God in their conversations and what they are doing and how they are handling things. That is the person that I want to be like, that I want to go with there. So in conclusion, again, what is your testimony like? If you were to get into a situation with somebody, say, that person constantly is serving God, or are you the kind of person that is self-sufficient? You are arrogant. You are proud. You can do things on your own and you don't want anybody's help. That's not how we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be going to those around us and asking for help. These three men that we talked about had the pride. They had went the prideful thoughts and the looks there. They had the destruction. All of these men fell. Daniel here is the beacon, is the light, the example there. Every time he is mentioned, every time he talks about whether he is asking to eat the vegetables or he is telling about a dream or he is interpreting the writing on the wall, or he's coming out of the pit of lions, he gives every single ounce of credit back to God. He doesn't take any of that for himself. And we can take that example for us today and look at the fact that Daniel was not the proud one. He is one of only three or four characters in the Bible that is a major character of the Bible that something negative is not mentioned about him. He was human, so obviously he sinned. But his testimony is one throughout the last several thousand years that God did not record a fault of Daniel's. Do you have the kind of testimony where God would not record your faults? Or do you have and even with your faults though, with all of those things that take place there, David himself, he sinned, but he was still called a man after God's own heart. So no matter where you're at in your spiritual life now, whether it is one where the pride is taking over or you are fully committed to God, the area of pride and all of those things is something we all have to work on. We have to battle daily and remember our testimony so that when somebody does ask your coworkers, ask your family, ask those around you, they can say that you serve continually the God of heaven. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for the testimony that we have of Daniel and of his actions here and the humility that he showed and the power that he gave back to you and all of those things. As said, the testimony, the negative testimony of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar, and Darius, but would be one that we can grow and learn from and realize that pride is not the answer, that we are all facing it there. Help us and protect us, Lord, from that haughty spirit and from the pride that will come into our lives. And I ask these things in your Son's name. Amen. Earlier for the offertory, Valerie played the song "Holy, Holy, Holy." Song. What page number is that? I'd like to sing the final verse of that song this evening as a closing, and just remembering that He is the one that we are serving. It is that holy God, that one that we are going there. That our pride is something that is completely against what that holy God has done for us. It's song number 68 in your hymnals. We'll sing the fourth verse there.